Hello and welcome to The Double Pivot, the world's most agreeable soccer analytics podcast. I am Michael Cayley. We are back here on the Friday after Thanksgiving because there was a little bit of soccer. And there were a bunch of games, but I mean, come on. We're talking about the Usman. A little bit of England because it's related, but we're talking about the Usman. I'm joined by Mike Goodman, who is really happy to just like keep talking about soccer, doing work on soccer. It's his favorite thing. He loves the sport. He would never complain about having a job in soccer. That's what I hear.
Having a job in soccer is wonderful. Having a job in soccer that starts at 5 a.m. for 2 weeks straight is somewhat less wonderful. Having a job in soccer that starts at 5 a.m. for 2 weeks straight and having your three-year-old come into the bed at 4 a.m. and lose her mind is somewhat less wonderful. The music you heard on the way in is the Wailers. Please download, subscribe, make us happy as podcasters. Patreon.com/doublepivot. We have a Discord now. If you're a Patreon subscriber, you get into the Discord. Everybody chats about soccer and stuff. It's lots of fun. It is, of course, a Double Pivot Discord, so they chat about lots of other stuff, too. They chatted about the U.S. men in England. That was a fun game. I was not in the Discord, because I have a job in soccer at the time. But yeah, let's talk about it. 0-0. Fifth 0-0 of the tournament. The 0-0 kind of hits different when you're very emotionally invested, though.
Yeah, that's the thing, is it was like nearly impossible for me to say after the game exactly how bad it was because I was like living and dying with every pass, like some sort of loser who cares about his national team. Ugh, it is the worst. I do think the best I can put this together, I think that the first half was more of a reasonably competitive soccer match with some amount of back and forth and some good play to get into the final third. And the second half was just a big scrum in midfield.
Yeah, I think that that seems right. And I mean, I think it's interesting to sort of talk about that and the reasons for it. But let's just sort of talk through the game, I guess.
So England bring out the exact same lineup and all of the same tactics from Iran.
100% the same. And the U.S. bring out almost exactly the same personnel. Almost. Haji Wright comes into the side and makes a surprise start for Josh Sargent, which is legitimately like, what? But then they get out on the field, and they're running a 4-4-2? 4-2-2-2 kind of a thing? It's very much... Like, Tim Weah is clearly playing striker next to Haji Wright. Like, that's what's happening here. Which is very interesting given that he ducked Grant Wall's question before the first match about whether or not he was getting striker reps. And, like, I was super hopeful he was going to play the point in a 4-3-3. But it turns out, I guess, that they were running, like, this package in training. And with him up top, Weston McKennie goes to the right. And it is a relatively flat four with Pulisic on the left and McKennie on the right, although both of those guys have lots of license to get forward at the penalty box in attack. And in support, your usual fullbacks in Dest and Robinson have license to get up the field and support the attack.
Because both Pulisic and McKennie do, especially when they defend, they defend on the wings. You could see them go into a four. But when they were moving the ball forward, they really came infield a lot. And so you have both of these guys moving into those half spaces and fullbacks running on behind, or the forwards could also, you know, run for, do an in-to-out run.
Which Tim Weah is very, very good at and did a lot of, and Haji Wright is less good at and did less of.
And so to me, I think the story of this game is that by playing this 4-4-2, which really liked to become as narrow as it could, the U.S. were able to disrupt the stuff that England did to Iran.
Yeah, like specifically, England's midfield was incredibly unimpactful in this match. And England's midfield is very good. And that's just like super notable.
Right, and the way that Iran played them was to sort of take out the midfield. Iran played them with a plan of we're going to sit deep, we're going to absorb pressure, and we're going to have a whole bunch of bodies on their midfielders. The problem was that playing that way allowed England's very good passers at center back and right back, especially, to be able to sort of sit back and pick passes. They get their first goal from a pass that comes from Stones. Stones is excellent the whole match. Trippier is excellent the whole match. And the other thing with the narrow 4-4-2 is it also has a 2 at the front.
Yes.
And so the U.S. were able to body up. You know, there were times when, the U.S. didn't, engage immediately at the top of the field. But any time England were working the ball, once they get into, the final 60, basically, there was pressure on those defenders. They were preventing the defenders from getting the service forward. The man who really should have been free was Declan Rice. That was the one that I kept, looking for. Are we going to get some sort of Rice pick up the ball and run?
Declan Rice got on the ball a lot. But what tended to happen is that whichever forward had not moved towards the ball and center back crashed back to get behind Declan Rice. So now Rice is receiving the ball still with three lines in front of him, and he is playing a tremendous amount of sort of come to the ball and play it sideways and everybody resets, which is more or less what the U.S. wanted to happen.
Exactly. He's playing center back passes, and Jude Bellingham really remains high. Bellingham is waiting for those combinations that worked so well against Iran, and so he's not able to get as involved in the play because it is getting blocked up before it can get to him in that, more advanced, better Calvin Phillips role.
Yeah, and occasionally England would break through and Jude Bellingham would be in the box and it would be scary. I think their first real attacking move, that's exactly what happened.
Yep.
And I want to be clear, this didn't mean that the U.S. entirely foiled England's attack at all. England was still able to build through the wings, especially on the left. And I think the reason that England's attack had to flow through their left was kind of twofold. One is that Serginho Dest is the U.S. right back, and from a defensive standpoint, he's not very good, and even by his not very good standards, he had a really rough game defensively. But two is that Luke Shaw is a much more typical attacking fullback who is looking to overload in wide areas. And Kieran Trippier on the right is a much more modern attacking fullback who is looking to receive the ball in the middle third of the field and play the ball up the field and is very good at that. But that sort of played into exactly the way the U.S. wanted to defend. Whereas moving the ball up the left quickly and overloading Dest and McKennie's side, they had a much harder time dealing with.
Yeah, so Shaw completed 4 out of 5 passes into the penalty area. He was England's ball progression attack. And, that's both very good. Shaw had a very good game, but also if England are attacking you primarily through Luke Shaw, you have done a good job taking away their, options A, B, and C.
Right. No, I think on a lot of days, maybe not a lot of days, but certainly on some days, option D just would have worked.
Oh, yeah.
Although, on other days, the amount that the U.S. built through Serginho Dest to move the ball from their from their own third into the middle of the pitch would have worked and eventually created a goal for them. I thought, again, Dest played a quite strong game on the ball, moving the ball up the field, and playing, even more than against Wales, as a tucked-in right back who was getting the ball and doing Kieran Trippier things with it more than he was doing, the things that we think of Serginho Dest as an attacker doing, which is overlapping and attacking the box and all of these things. He was much more, again, involved in build-up, which is if he can do that, that's a full attacking package. And I think that both of us sort of doubted that he was good enough on the ball to make up for his defensive deficiencies. And it's 2 games, so I still doubt that. But in these 2 games, he has been quite good. And just sort of as a Dest-related aside, you could see how much the U.S. depended on Dest's presence on the ball to work the attack. Because as soon as he was subbed out and Shaq Moore was subbed in, Shaq Moore kept getting the ball and giving it away. Because Shaq Moore is not very good on the ball, but this team was built to go through those areas in that player. So,
yeah, Dest had a pair of carries into the penalty area, received a bunch of progressive passes, you know, was very tidy in possession. All of those things were really good. One other thing to mention here is the sort of like the discourse that captured the Usmant fandom before the match was that because Iran had beaten Wales in the early game, this match became one where the difference between a draw and a loss was very small. And so, you know, the U.S. either way just needs to win against Iran. Either way, a draw against Iran is not good enough. And so the question was, do you play a rotated side? In particular, what do you do with your players who are on yellow cards and your players who have fitness concerns? And what Greg Berhalter did is that at 75 minutes, he was like, yo, that's enough. I'm taking the guys on yellow cards out.
Yes.
And also taking out McKennie, who is still recovering. And so,
but also I on think, a yellow card.
And, exactly. And McKennie was the intersection of these points. And so that definitely made the U.S. worse, in particular at right back. I thought that, you know, Aronson was fine. But like McKennie was having an excellent game, but you take him out and they did like sacrifice a little bit of a chance of a win at the end to make sure that they didn't lose those guys for the next match.
At that point, like, what are you going to do? Like,
exactly.
But it was, like, I mean, I found the game legitimately interesting, and it is also interesting that there were like no expected goals. It was like under one for both sides here, I think.
Yeah, the only clear chances in the match, and that's the opta definition, but I think it's more or less correct, are the play where Weah managed to find that cutback. The U.S. looked for cutbacks a lot, yes, as did England, and most of them did not come off. The one that did, it was really more of a sort of ball across the face, square ball.
A square ball that was fizzed across the face from the wing.
Yep, and McKennie managed to find space right around the penalty area, and just, you know, puts a, all you got to do is direct it and put a foot to it. But the ball's bouncing just a little bit, and he puts it over. England had one or two of those, but they were every time the U.S. had a defender there.
Yeah, there was an early one for Kane that I think it was Zimmerman just sort of like threw himself in front of and managed to block.
Yeah,
that to me was the most notable one.
Yeah, and then from there, it's really just like the set pieces at the end, and Kane eventually gets his head on one from about 8 to 10 yards, where, like, you know, he just doesn't get it clean. He gets it very cleanly in the wrong direction. He doesn't get the angle right. But, you know, he had a clean hit at that ball.
I will say one thing though is that I tweeted this towards the end of the first half, that there were just a number of situations where England had the ball in the box and didn't get shots. And this wasn't like they were breaking at speed and, you know, Tim Ream makes a great play to cut out a pass kind of thing. This was just like they had the ball in the box and it seemed like inevitable that somebody would try a shot. And it didn't happen. And it definitely felt to me at the end of that first half, when you looked at it, and it was like the U.S. sort of had statistically a small advantage, that my reaction to that was like, yes, but. Like, to me, it felt like the XG and the number of shots that England got from their having the ball in that first half was well towards the low range of what you would think they would get from that kind of possession.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that a number of England's players in midfield and in their back line, Shaw excluded, had poor games in ways that I would very much tend to credit to the way the U.S. approached this match. The fact that Sterling and Saka and Kane didn't connect for good chances.
And Mount, too.
Mount's been weirdly anonymous as an attacker, like, not just for England, but like for a while for Chelsea as well, in ways that I am somewhat confused by. But like, at least, like, some of these guys, you would have expected a little bit more to come off in ways that, yes, U.S. defenders made plays, but usually those guys just, like, it's not possible for defenders to make all of the plays.
Yeah, and, I mean, there were things that the U.S. was doing. Like, Tyler Adams was clearly, like, by design, really aggressive at doubling and even tripling up on the wing when the ball went to the wing. I think there was this... I mean, it seemed to me from the outside you can tell a coherent coaching story about what Berhalter was trying to do, which is to say, okay, from the front we're going to press and force them to bring the ball up the wing if they want to attack. Once the ball comes up the wing, Tyler, your job is to make sure that you double up on the ball on the wing, and it is the press of the wingers and the forwards helping, and whoever, and Musa, to make sure that passes are not allowed into the middle spaces of the field that you are vacating. And, like, that kind of worked. Like, there weren't, like, a lot of times where you would see Adams go to the wing and the ball would get reversed to the middle of the field and you'd be like, uh-oh. But at the same time, like, England was just able to move the ball into the box from the wing, especially on the left, a lot. And just, like, it never... fully developed into shots.
Yeah. One thing that's interesting about this U.S. defensive performance in the midfield and the wing is that it does not pop in the on-ball numbers.
Yeah.
You know, Adams, you can sort of move around here. Like, Adams and Robinson having 8 and 7 ball recoveries gives you some sense of how well these guys were picking up the ball, and those tended to be, you know, not particularly deep. But, like, Adams had a tackle and an interception, you know? Robbins had a tackle and 2 interceptions. Musa had 2 tackles, and McKennie had 2 tackles. Like, these are, and those were, like, those happened at important points, but to a great degree what the U.S. did, the effectiveness of it shows up in the England stats rather than the U.S. stats. Because what Adams was doing was constantly, like, harrying players, shepherding them into situations where they could not move the ball where they wanted to. And you can see this in England's general failures to move the ball, and certainly the lack of shots, and then the failure to move the ball to do anything other than have Shaw move the ball in the penalty area. That all comes off. But if you're trying to, like, piece it together as what individual U.S. players did, you would need different statistics than the on-ball statistics we have right now to really fully piece it together. I think that my opinion watching the game was that it was Adams, first and foremost, who, I mean, obviously that was his job, but he was constantly the guy who was stopping the ball. And then it was really Musa and McKennie and Pulisic, all of them, sort of picking up some of the slack where he missed it.
I think, especially in the first half, I thought Yunus Musa had a really above average, especially for Yunus Musa, defensive performance.
Yes.
Actually, and on the ball too. I thought Musa played a very good first half. And then I think he was fairly anonymous in the second half, and it's a chicken and egg problem. I don't know if the game became muddy on the U.S.'s side because Musa became anonymous, or if Musa became anonymous as the game became muddy. But he was not nearly as ever present on the ball, and he was not nearly as combative off the ball either. He did not find himself around the ball nearly as much.
Yeah, which is obviously the classic Yunus Musa question. It's not whether he can do stuff when he gets the ball.
Right.
It's how often is he doing stuff. And in the first half, he really did. This is sort of the question. As the U.S. ends up, you know, they've got to beat Iran. If they beat Iran, they're going to be playing some good teams. Probably the Netherlands, who we can talk about. And they had a dubious match. But, like, this is not a team the U.S. is going to be, you know, the U.S. is going to be second best in talent in a lot of situations on the field. And if they get through that one, whole bunch of teams, U.S. are second best in talent, as they were against England. And what they need to have then is midfielders who are making plays defensively. And Yunus Musa was that guy for a half, which I was, you know, happily surprised by, but then he was not that guy for the second half.
That's right. And yeah, because I remember thinking around halftime, like, the thing that I am tickled by about this performance is how much of it is predicated on guys that I had major questions about doing the things that I questioned about, specifically Musa and Dest. And now Dest has done that for almost two full games, but Dest has also, like, he's just been better at the things I thought he was already good at. He has not been better at the things I thought he was bad at. He's been quite bad at the things I thought he was bad at. But Musa, I thought, like, that first half was as good as I've seen him, which I found interesting because he didn't have any of those, like, super wow moments. But he was just good on the ball frequently, which is what you need out of Yunus Musa.
Talk a little bit about McKennie, because McKennie has now, under Pirlo at Juventus, this is a role he played a lot. Which is a winger who is, you know, it's not a fake winger. He really does have to defend that wing. But he's able to, from that role, affect the game through ball progression and get into the penalty area. And, like, you know, he didn't finish that one big chance, but this is a game where he filled up the stat sheet. He's got two shots.
Man, I thought he was so good.
Two shots, one shot assist, 90% pass completion. He's got two passes into the penalty area completed. He's got three progressive passes completed. He also has three progressive passes received. He also receives the ball in the penalty area three times. So he's able to be a key part of the U.S. buildup and be getting into the penalty area and be doing the defensive work that they needed on the wing while also tucking in and being a part of that midfield blow-up. I mean, this was, like, coming into the game, the way I was sort of thinking about this, I decided not to post about it because people would get really mad and I could be, like, wrong a little bit this way or that way, so I didn't want to make people mad when I didn't feel really confident in the take. But, like, I was sort of thinking about the U.S. squad and feeling like McKennie and Adams and Pulisic, all of them, you could make the case that they should be in the England squad if they were English. But also, if they missed the squad, you'd be kind of like, eh, they missed the squad, you know?
Right, yeah.
And I felt like I didn't even make that post, and yet McKennie and Adams showed up to play at a level they were outplaying the England players that I said, you know, would have said in that post, had I made it, should be ahead of them.
And, like, let's be clear, Christian Pulisic way outplayed Raheem Sterling in this match.
Yes.
And I don't know, like, Anthony Robinson played really well defensively. He had in attack and defense, he played really well. But Raheem Sterling, like, there should be, I think, if you watched game tape, you will be able to say specific things that Raheem Sterling was doing poorly and the U.S. were doing well that left him so utterly absent. But I couldn't tell you what they are, having only watched the game once. But he was, like, just, you know, Sir also appearing in this film. Like, he did nothing. Pulisic was great. And I, you know, we talked about how good Pulisic was in the first game and, you know, how much he filled up the stat sheet and how a couple things just didn't quite come off. And there was some criticism of him that I think is fair criticism, that the second half game plan for the U.S. against Wales was absorb pressure and counter through Pulisic. And Pulisic was, like, relentlessly conservative upon receiving the ball. And I think that that's fair. He was so pitch perfect tempo-wise in this game, in terms of when to go and when to check back and retain possession. And on top of that was just absolutely everywhere in the attack, creating shots for himself, moving the ball forward, moving the ball into the box, creating opportunities for others. And he did it on the side of the American field that was less cohesive. McKennie, Dest, and Weah move really well together. And you can tell how many reps they have playing together. Haji Wright, Pulisic, Musa, and Robinson over on that side are not as fluid. They just kind of want to be in the same spaces a little bit more. They just kind of don't read where the other one is going a little bit more. And despite that, Pulisic was just absolutely dominant in that area. Just absolutely dominant. And almost won the U.S. the game a couple times.
Yeah, I mean, 4 shots and a shot assist while being heavily involved in build-up in midfield is just a really, really impressive match. And it is too bad for the U.S. You had this game where, like, your 3 stars show up, that they didn't get, like, one more guy, especially a forward, to really show up. It was a fine match for Weah. He did assist the McKennie chance.
Didn't have a shot, though.
He was also, you know, a fair bit more involved in moving the ball forward on that wing. But, like, it's certainly not, like, one of his better games. It was fine.
Yeah.
And Wright gave them nothing.
The thing that you can see about the forwards playing together in this manner is that whenever the ball went forward, you know, sort of towards the wing in the half spaces, the U.S. had bodies forward in the box. And it was, you know, there was never a question that there would be 3 or 4 guys lining up if you wanted to put the ball in the box, which is not usually the case for the U.S. And, I mean, part of that is just, like, Haji Wright's presence. And part of that is Weah's presence, because Weah is not the guy out wide now who is putting the ball in a lot of the time. Somebody else is wide and he is in the box. The problem is that none of those guys ever got on the end of anything except McKennie. So, like, I don't know. Like, I know Haji Wright gels with these guys and everything. And I know that both Jesus Ferreira and Josh Sargent are guys that contribute a lot by sort of dropping in and leaving and not testing the back line, but being involved in touching the ball and pressing. And that's not what this role called for in this match. I mean, in this match, you really do want guys who are going to stay up at the back line, who are going to threaten the back line, who are going to get in the box, whose whole deal is that. But, like, you had Jordan Pefok, who you didn't call it. I don't know. You have Ricardo Pepi. Is he that guy? Like,
he stays high. I mean, that's certainly...
Yeah. Clearly, you have this in the hopper, right? Like, this game plan didn't occur to Greg Berhalter after he made the roster choices. But you decided that it's Haji Wright, and I don't really get that.
Yeah, he definitely didn't show that in this game.
No.
For certain. I really have no idea to what degree we're actually going to see this again.
Yeah, it's a good question, right? It's a really good question. I don't think you're going to see it against Iran, right? Like, I think you may see something else. Like, I think you legitimately might see a band of 3 attack, like a full band of 3 attackers plus a striker against Iran. That would not surprise me. Like, if you were going to be like, we're just going to try to get Gio, Aronson, Reyna, McKennie, and Adams all on the field for this one. Like, we like Yunus Musa. We think Yunus Musa is really good in transition. We think we just want to have all of the ball this match and there's not going to be transition. It wouldn't shock me. And, like, we know that Berhalter likes to make these calls. And, like, he nailed this call. We don't know if he'll nail the call against Iran, but, like my guess is he's going to make a call, whatever it is. That you're not going to get sort of what I would consider the basic cookie cutter 4-3-3, which we did get against Wales, and which was fine for the first half against Wales.
You know, if the U.S. does get through, and they get the Netherlands, this seems like a very good way to match up against the Netherlands.
Yeah, it does. I am not doing that. I am very uncomfortable to the degree with which you have done this already on this podcast. I am not doing that. Let's go beat Iran. Like,
we're analyzing soccer, man, from a neutral perspective, from the standpoint of nowhere, just objectively looking at our spreadsheets, looking at our numbers, coming up with ideas.
We could not possibly be biased in any way, shape, or form. We do not have biases.
Obviously not.
We just calls them as we sees them. Yeah, I don't know. Like, yes, I mean, you are right that there are a number of teams you could see this system being played with.
It's a system that's built to take the game to a team with better talent.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Well, I mean, I think what's interesting here is that there's like a typical thought, right, where you always want to have one more defender than attacker, and that there's this thought that it's like, it's the defender's impetus, right? It's the defensive side's impetus to do that, and you do it to contain the attackers. But I do think that it's worth, like, considering the flip side, which is that you don't want just one attacker against a team that likes to build with three players in the back. And now, building with three players in the back can mean three center backs, but it doesn't have to, right? Like, Maguire, Stones, Trippier is a system that wants to build with three players at the back. We talked a bunch about the weird-ass Netherlands thing with Daley Blind, right? And I think that if you have three passers at the back against a team that only has one who is, like, tasked with harrying the back line, you have a pretty decisive build-up advantage. Now, there are, like, ways you can adjust for it, and sort of every team kind of is like, oh yeah, well, we play under, you know, the attacking midfielder behind the striker is supposed to step up and be that second guy. Or, like, this winger is supposed to pinch in high and be that second guy. But, like, also, it often doesn't happen, or it happens less, or it happens less committedly, or it happens less ably when you do it that way, for a lot of reasons. And just Berhalter going to a system in which we have two attackers, one of whom always steps to the ball on his side when the center back or Trippier has it, and closes down, it makes a difference in build-up for your opposition. It just really does.
Yeah, so thinking about the Iran match, that match definitely will happen. I'm not jinxing anything.
Correct.
By mentioning it. I guess I have jinxed some sort of global crisis that causes the World Cup to get cut short. But other than that, I think this the way that Iran approached Wales to me was not really any different from the way that Iran approached England. They had Sardar Azmoun. That makes it better.
Right.
But the basic idea was that they were going to absorb pressure deep, occasionally spring some pressure on the midfield, and try to move the ball quickly with low passes into the channels for a striker. And they were never able to do this because England pinned them back incredibly well and then had very good defensive midfielders back to handle any time that they tried to play out with those balls to the channels. Wales were, like, literally the opposite of that. And Iran, actually, I think, as the match grew, they got more aggressive as they realized that they could make Ampadu, and in particular Ramsey, just completely shut them down and win the ball off of them over and over and over again. And then, you know, once you don't have a midfield that's stopping you from playing balls into the channels, you just have a lot of freedom to get your head up and look for the runner. And they were able to do that. Once, you know, Azmoun was run, they were able to do that. That wasn't actually how they got their goals in the end.
You know, they were already up a man. Things had gotten weird.
Exactly. But the reason they're up a man has a lot to do with, you know, again, that was a ball into the channel that Hennessy has to try to come and stop.
Well, he doesn't have to. He decides to.
It was not a good Wales performance, but it was really the same Iran performance. And I think that, like, it should be reasonably easy to game plan that this is what they're going to do.
I think here's the question, right? Like, the Iran performance from England to Wales was, we are tactically going to do the same thing. We are just going to do it with one less defender and one more attacker on the field. Right? Because they go from the back three to the back three, five to the back four, and they have Azmoun. And that's the whole thing. Like, and so I think it's an open question as to which way they're going to approach the US. I think it matters in terms of how you want to approach breaking them down, but either way, you can assume you're going to have the ball. And I don't know, like, if they go to a back four, I think there's an argument for, like, just sort of shifting yourself and arranging yourself into this 4-4-2 and being like, yeah, we're just going to pump balls into the box. We're going to have a lot of the ball. We know that Dest and Robinson can get up the field and do traditional winger things if we ask them to. It's relatively lighter risk to do that than it usually would be because of how Iran plays. You know, there's not going to be a tremendous amount of pressure on building into those areas. And, like, if we can get a header from Sargent, you know, McKenny attacking the box, like, that's, we're just going to brute force our way through. That would be a reasonable approach to me. I think that's less reasonable if Iran go for a more defensive lineup. And then you have to sort of figure out, okay, where do we get our volume from then? Like, how do we keep getting sort of Pulisic and whoever else is starting, like, just firing away from 19 yards over and over and over and over again? Because I don't really think what you want to do against this Iran side, happily defending deep, is keep trying to unlock them.
Right, because the thing is that's exactly what England did, but England has Jude Bellingham.
Right, and like, we have Weston McKennie, but the US having Weston McKennie is like, okay, he's going to run forward into the box and you should kick him, you should let him attack across.
Right.
No, I mean, but England also only had two XG and change in that match. Like, Saka stuck it in the corner when he cut in from the wing from 19 yards. Like, that was what he did and how they scored. So, you know.
Yeah, I mean, they did really just smush Iran until it was in garbage time. They gave up some chances.
Right.
And so, it, again, as we've said a bunch of times, that England performance in the first match was not a changed England. It was England playing a very, very good defensive match and having some of the medium chances that they create get converted at a very high rate.
My favorite, I went through this for the newsletter, is that England's XG by Opta or Stats Performs XG was less than Argentina and Germany's. Which, like, yeah, I mean, I really do believe that, like, if you look at those matches, especially Germany created a ton more against Japan than England did against Iran.
Yeah, it's definitely true of Germany. I think I had Argentina's well under England.
Including the penalty.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I had England a little over 2, and I had Argentina at, like, 1.1 plus the penalty. So it's pretty close. And I think that a lot of that has to do with, you know, my system absolutely loves everything about Jack Grealish's chance, and I feel good about that. But, like, there's a huge XG number on that, and then it really deprecates the chance for Taliafico because it's not assisted. It's a shot to a shot.
Yeah.
And those are scored at a relatively low rate. In that case, like, Taliafico, I think that, like, XG is, my XG as well, is clearly overrating that Taliafico chance. It just bounces off his leg. But, yeah, it's definitely the case that England performance was, like, you know, it's a 2XG
right
performance.
Yeah, exactly. And again, like, I don't know, I think Opta has it as, like, 0.6 and change for the Grealish one. So it's like, significantly less than that until very at the end. And, like, honestly, I think Grealish's XG there should be higher than 0.6. And, like,
exactly. That's in the same garbage time area where Iran also got some chances.
Anyway, all of which is to say, like, England remain exactly who we thought they were, which is a very good team that I picked to win the World Cup. So,
yeah, like, another thing here is that if you got too high on England as, like, a really fun attacking team because they finished their chances against Iran, this is surprising. If you thought that England were pretty much the same team and they came out and played the same way and they're playing Gareth Southgate football, and it should be said, a team came up, played them really well, punched them in the face a bunch of times, got one good scoring chance in 90 minutes. Like, this is a crazy good England defensive team.
Absolutely.
They remain what we thought they were. And I really don't have a clear handle on either how the U.S. will or how the U.S. should approach the Iran match, because this is a match where they should expect to have possession and get goals from that. And in CONCACAF, they really didn't like doing that. In CONCACAF, they like to try to create higher event matches rather than hold the ball and build. And I don't think that Iran are just going to let them do that if the U.S. tries to screw up the game. And I'm not sure that that's a good way to approach an Iran team that has as many good runners at forward as they do. So I just don't have a good handle.
Yeah, that's why I really feel pretty strongly that what you want to do is just create a high volume of mediocre shots.
Yeah.
I'm confident from having watched Greg Berhalter manage for a long time that he, like, sort of thinks about the game the way I do. And, like, it is very, like, within the realm of possibility that that is something that, like, Greg Berhalter wants to do. But, like, coaching and managing human beings and instituting tactics and stuff is, like, a messy, inexact process. And, like, there's a reason that people like me are not head coaches. And like, you can't just, like, flip the switch to, like, slide the tactic slider to, like, make that happen. So it'll be an interesting process.
Well, we will be back. There were some, basically what we've been doing is we've been doing some of those free side podcasts that we pick up, and there's also been a subscription podcast at patreon.com/doublepivot. That's where we talked about France and Spain and England again. That's where we talked about Canada. And these games are not going to stop. We're going to have takes on the games as they continue, and they'll be here. Thank you for listening, and you can go to patreon.com/doublepivot for even more takes. And then you can join the Discord, and then you can share your takes too. We're having a real good time. We got four match threads every day. We're rolling. So yeah, thanks.
How do you feel about being people that know what match threads are in a Discord?
Yeah, I'm on all the chat. I'm on all the chat rooms.
That got a real old school IRC feel at its best, kind of.
Exactly. Exactly.
We're old. We're so old.
I hope everybody had a happy Thanksgiving or whatever it was on the regular week of their lives.